decided to speak about something which is much more close to real world than we had heard this morning. In fact, I hope I will not bore the mathematicians by becoming close to this dirty reality. So I will speak about surfaces, in particular about this kind of surface, which you all know. This is the shape created by the landscape of moving sand, dunes. And you recognize, I'll show you some pictures just to tune you in. These shapes are characterized by very sharp edges. They are, or they look random, so they fit very well into the subject of this workshop. And you see everywhere these crests, as they are called, these sharp lines. And these objects are, these dunes are also important to be studied because they can cover block roads, they can invade cities, like here, this is the capital of Mauritania. You see all these dunes arriving from the northeast, and they can also cover fields. And what is particular, what you see is the dunes are have, on one hand, the property that they are created by the transport of grains, so another word which makes us fit into our workshop subject. And on the other hand, what you recognize is that they form characteristic patterns. This is a problem of pattern formation. So here, for instance, you see the wind is coming from this direction. You see that there are these linear structures perpendicular to the wind direction, which are called transverse dunes. And here on the field, where you have less sand available, another structure appears, these croissant-shaped dunes that move with their horns in the direction of the wind, and they are called barkans. Barkan here, this is the Turkish origin name. And they are very typical structures, and in particular, they are shape invariant. That means that once they have formed, they move with a constant velocity and don't change anymore in shape. And they consist of two areas, and they are separated again by this very sharp edge, this crest. The area where the wind comes from, this area has more or less small slope, typically 10 degrees. And here the sand is transported by the wind. And the area behind the crest, which is called the slip face, is where the sand slides down in form of avalanches. So the driving force is gravity, and the slope is about 35 degrees. So these barkans, they appear all over. They appear in big fields. For instance, here, the most studied one in Peru, you recognize here the crest. You see the slip face with all the traces from avalanches. And behind here, we see the side which is driven by the wind.
When you have the same kind of sand and the same kind of wind velocity, do they form a characteristic scale or do they appear on different scales?
The size can changes when they collide. So it's very difficult to produce them in a controlled way because they are too big. Mm-hmm. So you can only essentially observe in the field. And then you always get different sizes.
Different sizes.
And then when they have different sizes, then they collide and produce again different sizes, so it does never stop. And they also exist on Mars. And at the end of my talk, I will talk again about Mars dunes. So this gives you a sign that the talk is at its end. Good. So the aim of my talk here is to derive equations of motion for the dunes, or in general, equations of motions for a free granular surface, which is driven by an external fluid. So what I want is to have an equation where we have here some function of the wind strength, of the grain diameter, of the gravity, and of all the relevant parameters, which at the end we'll see which they are. So as I said, the air, the fluid, you know, is essential for the formation of dunes. and the equation of motion of the air of the fluid is known to be the Navier-Stokes equation, the incompressible one, which I just will show you, I guess everybody has seen them. And this, of course, can be solved three-dimensionally on top of the existing dunes. This is the brute force, let's say, approach one could try. In fact, one can study the wind motion also in many ways, experimentally. Here I show you what happens when you release smoke on top of the crest of a barkan. And you recognize that there is a separation point here, S. Above the separation point, you have essentially laminar flow. And below the separation point, you have a backflow. And if you will study now the topography of a dune with numerically, so that you solve the Navier-Stokes equation of the three-dimensional dune shape, this is now a cut, a longitudinal cut through the dune, then you recognize that the velocity, which is in this laminar region, is much higher than the velocity in the backflow. You see the velocity backflow is much lower here.
This is 3D simulation.
It's a 3D simulation, but I'm also showing you a 2D cut. So what you recognize is that the slip phase, which is this part, you see this is the crest, this is the slip phase. The slip phase is in a region which is where the wind is too weak to transport grains. So the physics of a dune is that the sand grains are transported by the wind uphill, and then they fall into this hole, and there they stay, because the wind is too weak. So the slip phase essentially is like a wall that creates some kind of shadow. And so essentially, the dune is a trap of sand for sand grains. So the sand makes its own trap. This is the physics behind. Yes, sir.
So, but this Navier-Stokes equation, you have to solve the time-dependent boundary condition, right, in order to get the...
This has been done, that you impose on this side a logarithmic, I will come to this later in more detail, you impose a logarithmic velocity profile here and here the same. And the reason why you impose logarithmic, I will tell you in a minute. Because what happens is that here we have a turbulent flow, because this is atmospheric. So we have to use a special type of solution of the Navier-Stokes equation called the K-epsilon one. But these are all technical details. I want to just here show you, because anyway, I'm not going to stick with this three-dimensional simulation. So what I want to do, I want to derive equations in which I do not need to have this heavy 3D calculation, which is much too complicated, because in an equation of motion, the surface is going to change, and each time that the surface changes, I have to recalculate the velocity field of the wind. And this is too much, three-dimensionally. So what I want to do is I want to reduce everything to two dimensions. And there, considering the air, the wind, some work has been done in the past, which I will not go into all detail, I will just show it to you. So what is known is, well, this is just it. What is known is that the velocity increases with height. At the bound, at the bottom, at the floor itself, the velocity of the wind is zero, because this is so-called no-slip boundary condition. And the increase with height is logarithmic. So if that you have the height is z, the distance from the bottom is z, and z zero is a characteristic length, which is very small, called the roughness length, which is of the order of the millimeter. And in front of the logarithm, we have a prefactor, u star. And this u star is used in the literature in general to describe the strength of the wind, to have a unique measure for the strength of the wind. Because otherwise, you would have to specify at which height you measure the wind. Because since the wind velocity is height dependent, you need to decide it. So this u star is going to go with us now all the time as the variable with which I characterize the strength of the wind. And it is known since Prandtl, since 1924, that all this stuff of behavior, and also it's known since Prandtl that the stress that the wind exerts on the bottom, which is called tau, is proportional to u star squared. Okay, so these are essentially in the beginning, empirical facts that later have been derived in several different ways. Now, since we know that the profile is logarithmic, one can now imagine to integrate down this logarithmic profile, considering the condition of incompressibility, in order to obtain the force, the shear force exerted by the wind on the surface of a hilly landscape. This is the next task. And this task was fulfilled by some mathematicians in Cambridge during the 70s, by Jackson, Hunt, and Carrozer. So he spent about 10 years doing this work. It's not easy, yes? And so I show you here first, just because it is easier to explain, the one-dimensional version. So tau of x is the shear stress exerted as function of the space x. Tau zero is the shear stress that you have on the plane when there is no hill, just flat. Yes. So this is given by the wind strength in a simple way. And now we consider how does this wind stress change if I have a height profile given by the function h. And what you see is that this correction, all this parenthesis here has two terms. This term here is a local term, which says that the change of the stress is proportional to the gradient, to the slope, the local slope. And this is clear to understand because the higher the slope, the more the wind is deviated by the hill. And the first term, this non-local term, this integral term, takes into account the non-local character of hydrodynamics. It tells you that if the wind comes over a mountain range, it will be weaker than it comes from the valley. And the fact that you have this, that it has this shape, as I said, is not at all trivial. It has to be calculated. And the two numbers, A and B, also they are known, like that will be 3.2 and 0.3.
This is assuming Levinov flow.
This is not assuming, this is assuming turbulent flow. All this law is true for turbulent flow. So this is assuming turbulent flow, but it is assuming also that this landscape is not too steep. So the local slope should not exceed 30 degrees. So it's an approximation for, let's say, hilly, a smooth landscape.
So this would be turbulent boundary layer theory then?
Yes. So this is the one-dimensional version, and I also dare to show you the 2D version so that you see that it exists.
Can I just ask one question?
Of course.
So where is the parameter z naught entering into this?
Z naught enters into z naught.
Just in A and B?
Into tau, zero. Z naught is constant, it's the same all over, mm-hmm. everywhere. It's constant of the surface roughness. So it enters into zero. Essentially, I mean, z naught is the relation. You see, z naught is a.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it doesn't cut off the integral.
No.
Okay.
The integral goes from minus infinity to infinity if you want, due to the incompressibility of the fluid. This is what enters. This is why.
I'm worried that why that integral that isn't divergent.
No, this is principal value, of course.
This is exactly. Yes.
Oh,
it's principal value. This is a Cauchy transform or Hilbert transform.
Okay, so this I'm supposed to understand this in the sense of Hilbert transform.
Yes. And here I show you the two-dimensional version of it. So it's much more cumbersome, uses modified Bessel functions and so on. So this is in Fourier space. So this wiggle means Fourier transformation. And then, okay. I don't think it is much use for you if I go through one by one. It's just to show you that this has been done and can be used. It has been tested, of course, also. I will show you later also a test of this. So in that sense, this part is known, and I will just use it so that we are able to obtain the shear stress of the wind as function of the shape of the landscape. Now comes the second part. The question, how is the sand transported by the wind? This is much more, let's say, new stuff. The pioneer on this field, however, is old guy. He was Mr. Bagnold, who worked as an engineer during World War II in the desert and who wrote a book, famous book, about his measurements. And he found out that there are three types of transport. If the grains are very big, let's say larger than 400 microns in diameter, then they cannot be taken up. So they will stay on the floor and they will just have a diffusive motion called creep. If the grains are very small, let's say less than 60 nanometers in diameter, then they will fly far away, they go in suspension, and they can cross the ocean. So they're too small for the relevant for the transport for dune formation. So only grains in the range between 100 and 300 microns are of interest, and what they do is they have a mechanism called siltation. What is siltation? Well, first of all, these things can all be reproduced in wind tunnels. I show you just a diagram. Here you have the wind velocity, here you have the grain diameter, and then you can study very detailed what you get. Here you have the region where you have siltation mechanism, here you have a suspension, here you have a deposition, and so on. So you can study this experimentally very well. So what is siltation? Siltation means that the grains do jumps. The grains are dragged out from the granular bed by some local fluctuation of this turbulent field, and they get a little higher up. And as I said, the higher you go, the larger is the velocity of the wind field. So they get accelerated at higher layers, they gain energy, and when they impact again, then they will create a splash of new particles, and these new particles will again make such trajectories. So we'll now make a parenthesis. I will talk a little bit more about the details of what happened there. But first, maybe I can show you a movie also, how this splash, this saltation looks like. So what you see is that there are it's like a surface of particles floating on top of the ground. You see? Well, probably most of you have already seen this in vivo. I can also show you this on top of a wet surface. It's maybe more visible. So the fact that they float, they seem to float 5 or 10 centimeters above ground, is due to the fact that the probability of finding it possibly at a certain height in these trajectories is highest at a certain height. So this is why you have this feeling, but in reality they are all doing these jumps.
What about in this wet sand situation, why don't they stick to the sand?
Because on top of this wet sand there is a layer, this is a very hot region,
oh,
this is Brazil.
Oh, I see.
And where they are.
Okay, so this is not wet sand. This is dark sand.
So one can now establish the limit, the maximum flux of sand, also in wind tunnels. This maximum or saturated flux I call QS. It's already Bagnold showed that this QS goes like the U star Q. And later measurements have shown that there is actually a threshold U star, it means a minimum velocity in order to create this process. So that the simplest empirical law for the flux is this given by Leto and Leto. So this is just empirically. So first thing one can try to do is to obtain this from a microscopic calculation. And I will now make this parenthesis in which I will show you some of the elements of how to do this calculation. So what we have is that our particles moving in the fluid, they have on top of the entire surface the so-called no-slip condition. It means that the velocity of the fluid must be equal to the velocity of the particle. So what you have to do is you have to solve the Navier-Stokes equation in a moving boundary problem, because each particle constitutes a boundary of the fluid. The force that is exerted on the particle now is then an integral over the entire surface of the particle of the so-called stress tensor, and the stress tensor is given by the pressure in the diagonal and by the off-diagonal elements is the viscosity. So this is just the mechanical background. Now one can describe this drag force in the high Reynolds regime. So if low Reynolds numbers is not interesting for our case, it means it's low velocities because the wind is typically high velocity, so let's forget the upper part. So what happened in our case is high Reynolds numbers. So we have a drag law which goes in this way, where there is a, in general, let's say this in general, this is a general law. We have a free factor, CD, and this free factor CD, so-called drag coefficient, can be measured experimentally and is a complicated function of the Reynolds number. So that is the knowledge that you need maybe to understand how particles are moved in a fluid. Now what we did is to do a concrete simulation of saltation. Yes?
Sorry, maybe I missed it. What's the difference between the two curves?
Oh, sorry. This is a curve in three dimensions and this is in two dimensions. This is so what we did is a simulation in which we now simulate wind channel, we impose a logarithmic profile and release the particles and look how they move using this kind of drag law. And what you find is that if the particles, if you have too many particles or the particles are too heavy, then these particles will just damp down and stop. And if the particles are too light or you have too few particles, then their trajectories will grow indefinitely. So that there exists a certain precise number of particles and mass of particles at which you have a steady state trajectory. And this constitutes the saturated flux. It means the maximum number of particles that the flow can carry. Yes?
What do you mean by too few or too many? The particles are not independent, they are correlated, or?
No. In this calculation, I just can release several particles at the same time, but they are so dilute that they will not see each other, which is the realistic situation. I mean, the probability of two particles come close is not so high.
So the size of this jump depends on what? In the stationary case?
The saltation length, the size of the length, depends on the U star, on the wind velocity. And that can be obtained with this simulation. And one can now study how the flux QS depends on U star. And can find that asymptotically, we find the U star cube law from Bagnold. And then we also reproduce that there exists a threshold value. And we find, this is new in that sense, that the singularity, how this goes to zero at the threshold value, is not a cubic law, but a quadratic law. So we find here, in fact, doing a careful analysis, which on the real system is difficult to do because of the strong fluctuations interpreted. So what we do here is we take average values of the flow velocity, of the wind velocity, and so we can make a very careful work. And we can also study how much momentum the fluid loses, because as you know, this is actually the reason why you saturate the flux, because the air loses momentum until it cannot carry more particles. And so here I show you now the profile of the wind, where I have a different differential profile. That means I take the undisturbed profile, which are perfect without particles, minus the profile carrying particles. And I show it for different number of particles, or different fluxes. What you see is that there's a particular height. This is the height here, and this is the differential profile, the difference between the two velocities, with and without particles. And what you see is that there exists a characteristic height at which most momentum is lost, which is precisely the height at which it's in the movie, it looked as if the particles were floating. And finally, one can also study this height as function of U star, and one finds that this is a linear function. It means that the height of flux of this flux saltation layer increases linearly with the wind velocity, with wind strength. Okay, so far about the local mechanism that produces the motion of particles. But unfortunately, in this way, we don't progress too much with individual particles. We need to have a continuum description of the flux evolution. And so, this is the work of my student, Gerhard Sauermann. One can use this process of saltation to derive how the flux increases and finally saturates. You remember that we had that at each collision, at each time a grain had an impact on the ground, we produced a certain number of particles. And this certain number of particles I call small n. And of course, as long as you produce at each trajectory more than one particle, the process is going to increase, and the flux is going to grow. Actually, if we would always produce, let's say, five particles each time, then it would grow exponentially with certain exponent. No. So what happens is that once the saturation that you reach of the flux means that this number n goes to 1. Okay? And when this happens, the drag, the sheer force of the wind on the ground will be reduced to become the threshold value. So this is the criterion for getting the saturated flux. So this is what I now write down here mathematically, that the changes of the flux are given by the flux of particles moving, the vertical component of the flux, times the difference between the ejection and the impact. So that means the difference between this term together is the erosion rate. It's how much is eroded. And when, of course, n equals 1, then there's no more increase or flux. And this vertical component of the flux, that means the number of particles that hit or leave the ground, is given by the flux of particles divided by exactly this length that you talked about, namely the saltation length, the average length of the trajectory. And so what can be done now is to study the system close to this point of saturation. It means to make a Taylor expansion of n of the number of ejected particles around the ratio between the shear force of the fluid at exerted by the particles and the threshold shear force. So this ratio will be 1 when we reach the saturated regime. And this Taylor expansion is written here, and the prefactor here is then the derivative gamma. And this number gamma is a parameter of the model. It describes how efficient the number of particles ejected changes when I leave the threshold shear force. Yes? And so this number depends on the grain diameter, it depends on the roughness of the grains. So this is a number which can be measured in the wind tunnel, but it cannot be obtained directly unless you make a detailed simulation. Now you can also describe, this is now the shear force at a certain moment, and this is the shear force without any particle, and so this is just the contribution of the drag of the particle. So this is the grain contribution, and so this can actually, I don't want to go much more in detail now, this can also be finally obtained, so I can put everything together and I get such an expression here. I put this here and this here and this here and I get this expression. And so at the end what it means, let me get a little, is that we have essentially a logistic equation. And that is not surprising, because the logistic equation is the simplest equation in which you have an exponential increase and a subsequent saturation. And this equation is now has now two functions, QS and LS, and QS is the limiting value of the flux. It means if QE reaches QS, then there is no growth anymore. So if I take away this parenthesis, we have just an exponential growth, and then when finally we reach, this growth stops when we reach QS. And in front of here, you have another function, which is the dimension of a length, which is called the saturation length, because it's a characteristic length. The system has to evolve until it starts to saturate. So if you want the curves, they look like this. We have an exponential increase with a typical length given by the saturation length, and then finally we have a plateau of saturation, which becomes higher the stronger U star, the stronger the wind strength. And the QS is now the function that we have had, let's say, the empirical function for the saturated flux, which I also showed you how to obtain in a numerical calculation. And the LS, this saturation length, now we also have, if you go back to our original derivation, we have derived it, and it's also a nonlinear function of U star. So what we have is we have two functions of U star or of tau, which are quite nonlinear. So everything is then, if you want, even more nonlinear. And here we have, a second equation, which relates the flux to the shear force tau. So let me now summarize where we are. We have three unknown fields. I write here the one-dimensional version, which are the profile, the one we really want to know, which is the shape of the landscape H, the flux of the sand on the surface Q, and the shear stress of the wind at the surface. And then we have two equations we have seen. One is the equation of the British, which is the integral to obtain the shear stress, and we have the logistic equation we just derived, which has these two nonlinear functions. So in order to close the system, we need a third equation, and for that we just use mass conservation, because it's just that how the profile, the height profile, does change with the flux, with the gradient of the flux. It's a continuum equation. So we have three equations and three unknown, and then we need to add, of course, initial conditions and boundary conditions, and we can solve everything. So this is the equation of motion for a surface which is driven by an external fluid. And I have fulfilled my first homework, which was to derive this equation, which is this is the new result. But unfortunately, this is not the full story, because in the beginning I told you that there exist also some regions behind the crest where we have avalanching. It means there is a second mechanism, which is the sliding due to gravity. And that is due to the fact, you can also describe it by saying that a granular surface, a dry granular surface, is unstable beyond a certain angle. You cannot maintain it in a state which is more steep than the so-called angle of repose. The angle of repose, which I call theta, is again a material property, which is a function of the shape of the grains and of the roughness of the grain surface. So for sand, it's typically 35 degrees, but for glass beads, it's 11 degrees. And so what we have is an extra condition telling us that the slope of our landscape must always be smaller than this tangent of theta. So what we have to do is we have to, after having calculated for its time step, let's say this new shape H, we have to go back and repair this. And we can do this in several ways, but imposing a fixed slope. One way of doing this would be using a diffusive model, which was introduced by Bouchot, Cates, and others, the so-called BCRE model, in which one introduces, it's a little complex to explain maybe now, but anyway, what one does is, one is studies as if one has another field R, which is the moving layer, and then one uses mass conservation, and here the fact that this now does not change, always establishes an angle which is equal to this angle of repose. So this is a way of smoothing the surface in such a way that it becomes gets a fixed slope.
Yeah, but are you actually accounting for the transport?
I'm not doing individual avalanches. The only thing I'm doing is that I'm assuring that that no mass is lost, and that at every place at which the slope was beyond the critical slope,
I see that.
Becomes a critical slope. So I don't look at the individual, but this equation here, in some sense, has mass transport, because the R function that I introduce here is a moving layer of particles. But I can do it simpler by just saying I do some kind of Maxwell construction, and I just put it. So I have several ways of doing it. So this is one way, and I have other ways. Yes?
What if you don't put in this constraint? Does it make a...
Then I get overhangs. I get horrible things. It looks like waves in the ocean. It can start to move. Yes. Then comes the second subtlety, which I have to tell you, which is that we have, as you told in the beginning, we have these regions of backflow. And of course, they cannot be part of my calculation of the wind velocity stress field. So what I have to do is I have to kind of, you have to reconstruct these separation bubbles. And what is done in the fluid mechanics literature is to just take ansatz of a smooth function, which typically one takes a third order polynomial, which just fulfills the condition of being here has a first derivative being the same, and here that it fits a certain point. So you just fit a polynomial surface that constitutes the limit between the region of laminar flow and the region of no flow. And then for the calculation of the stress field, one uses only the purple line. So this is another additional detail one has to take into account. And after having taken all this into account, one can finally can formulate a mechanism of evolution of these random surfaces, which is realistic, but unfortunately very complex. And for a mathematician, maybe it is not so funny. But unfortunately, reality sometimes doesn't give us a choice. So this system can now be solved numerically, and many things can be done. First of all, we can play around with it by studying what happens when I start with different initial conditions. I start with two different type of Gaussian hills, blue one and the red one, both having the same volume. Then after some time, the blue one loses its height and the red one increases its height until both of them finally have the same final shape. So this shows that the Barkan shape, which is two-dimensional way here, is an attractor. Second thing, I can now study initial conditions of different initial volume. And what I find is if the initial volume is very, very small, I don't get a slip phase. Only beyond a certain size, I get a slip phase. Here I see you show the final configurations, and you see that all of them have a slip phase, and only below a certain size, there's no slip phase. And that is exactly what is observed. One does not know on Earth stable dunes which are less than 1.5 meters in height. And it makes also sense with our picture, because we said that what stabilizes the dune is the existence of this slip phase, and then what one needs is that the particles really get inside and get stuck. But if the saturation length is larger than the size of the bubble, of this separation bubble, then the grains can just jump over it, and then we have no effect of trapping. So it must exist, and it does exist. Secondly, as a physicist, I am, of course, obliged to nature. My boss is nature. So we had to kind of measure also in the field if these equations are correct. So we went to see the largest dune in the world. This is in Brazil, Nogueira da Quara. It's 600 meters long, 400 meters broad, 50 meters high. It moves with 8 meters per year. Here you see the image, computer topography image, and you see here on the green line, we measured now the wind velocity along the green line. This is the cut over the green line. Here, this is the profile of the dune, and these are the data points of the wind velocity, and this black line is the equation of Jackson and Hutt. So within the error bars, it does work. I mean, quantitatively, with real units, with real numbers. And here I show you now the flux, the sand flux. Here's again the profile. Here are the data of the experiment. And the black curve is a logistical equation. While the dotted one is if I would just take the separated flux of Lettau and Lettau. And you see there are big problems here at the foot, which is understandable. And if I just don't take the logistic equation and just take the Lettau and Lettau equation, my dune will not move. It will just make a hole at the foot of the dune. Then we also looked at other types of dunes in the desert, because the other ones in Morocco, in Brazil, are coastal dunes. These are desert dunes in Morocco. And here we studied the entire dune field, which has dunes of different size. And we studied the shape of the dunes by making a longitudinal cut and a transverse cut. So this is now, the wind comes from here. This is a longitudinal cut. Here you see the slip faces. You see the crests. But what I have done is I've here shown you 8 different size dunes and collapsed them on top of each other so that they all have the same height. So what I rescaled for each dune the axis. So this is for each dune a different vertical and horizontal axis. And what you see here is the transverse cut. So I had the wind now comes from here, and I studied just at the center of the dune the profile. Again, 8 dunes. And now I show you, well, this is what you see here, is that the small dunes, they are these ones, and the large dunes are these ones. So it seems that the only difference between small and large dunes is that the position of the slip face is shifted. And at the end, what we find is that small dunes are this shape, and large dunes are that shape. Otherwise, the rest seems to be the same. And here you have now the solution of the equations on the left, and you have the experiment or the measurement on the right, and you see that we obtain again the same, exactly the same quantitatively, the same shapes. And here you see the same for the transverse cut. Of course, the fluctuations on the field are much larger. These are 8 dunes on top of each other, and you see it perfectly fits a parabola. So now we are happy. We have equations that reproduce nature. And now we go to the last step, which is now we play around with the equations, like a child. So the first thing we do is we just simulate, for instance, a dune field. We start with different heaps and see that some of them disappear and some of them grow. And this is now answering your question, now that at the end we don't have a fixed size. The size does change. This was now, of course, with a specific boundary condition, namely influx of sand, as a saturated influx, and then free outflux. Another simulation is now the genesis of dunes. So what I will show you now is a beach, completely flat, perfectly flat, and wind with sand flux influx. Now what you see is the system is unstable. It forms transverse dunes, and then it's even more unstable. It forms an entire dune field of Balkan dunes, of small Balkans. So what this shows, because, as I said, there was nothing, that there was, it was completely translation invariant in that direction. It shows that the numerical round of errors in the 14th digit, they finally escalate and produce this kind of noise. So it's very unstable. But one of the big challenges to mathematics would be to make a real stability analysis, which is not simple at all. I mean, what has been done is the stability analysis of the flat. The first one, that you have starting with a flat bed and putting on air wind, that you can get these transverse dunes. But from the transverse to this here, this has not been done. So next I show you what happens when I collide two dunes. So here I have the wind coming from here, and what we know is that the velocity of a dune is inversely proportional to its height, because the transport is a surface transport. And so the small dune is going to hit the large dune. Yes, first it becomes a barkan, as it should be, and now we go in the moving frame, so it seems as if they're not moving, but of course the frame is moving with them, and the large dune is in the shadow of the dune behind. So some part of it will stay behind. And this one that stays behind is eaten by the dune, the smaller one, which grows, because the larger one is losing matter, so it's getting smaller, and the one behind is getting larger, until the one which is in front becomes a smaller one. And at that point it can detach and can escape again. You see? So at the end, what we find is some kind of soliton behavior. You see, the small dune in front, and then the small dune in the back.
The size are conserved?
They are only conserved for a specific initial size. Only one case where the sizes are conserved.
Said another way, in this particular experiment, is the mass of the little one in front at the end the same as the mass?
That's why I just tried to explain. They are the same only if the ratio of these two initially has been chosen in a good way. If I choose them in different, there's one specific ratio between the sizes at which this one is going to be exactly that one.
So in general,
they are not. In general, they change the size a little bit, yes. So it's not solitons, but it looks like a little bit like solitons. In fact, at the end of my talk, I will say some more about that. Yes.
5 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So I show you also what happens when the smaller dune is even smaller, then it's so fast that it really jumps on the other one. And in this collision, they merge to a unit. But what happens then is that you get two babies produced at the horns. And this solves an old problem in geography, because there was always this famous picture of China of mega dunes, and in front of the mega dunes there were small dunes. Nobody understood where these dunes came from, because they should have disappeared in a long time. And our mechanism explains what's going on.
And then those small dunes are faster, and they should hit their parents and be devoured again, no?
If you take periodic boundary conditions, yes. But in reality, they will of course escape, like all the children do from their parents. They go away. Okay, now let me just make my final remarks. Yes, sir.
So, why is the wind always in one direction?
Oh, because in reality, there are cases in which it's in one direction, which is the one I showed you, but there are other cases in which it comes from different directions, and then you get different shapes. I did not show. There exist many shapes of dunes. There exist longitudinal dunes, for instance, which occur when the wind always alternates the direction with like two different directions. Then the crest also moves like this, and the dune becomes straight.
It's surprising that the wind may blow in one direction, some even a single place in the world.
No, this is along coast, it's quite common. Yes. Particularly when it's orthogonal to the ocean, then it comes in. Well, let's show you some other dune shapes. This is now, I always talk about the Barkan dunes, now I show you this longitudinal dune field. So also here, the equations can reproduce, of course, this effect. Then they exist in Brazil, a region called Lençóis, which is a beautiful landscape full of lakes. And they have this, what's called barcanoid, which also can be reproduced by the equations. Then we are also be able to add to this equation some equations for the growth of vegetation. Vegetation can either stop the dune motion, or the motion of the sand can destroy the vegetation, because it can, if the level of the sand rises or sinks too fast, then the vegetation is destroyed. And so when we can do this, we can have another new variable, which describes vegetation growth or vegetation height, which either grows with a growth rate or it decreases with a minus sign if the height of the floor of the ground changes too fast. And then we'll have to put this vegetation into the stress to couple, yes, because this is the effect of reducing the wind velocity due to vegetation. And this equation can be solved. And here you see what happens with the Barakan if I add vegetation. The green, this is the computer solution of the equation. So here you see the green is vegetation. Finally, the Barakan is transformed into a parabolic dune. It's stopped, it's fixed by nature. Nature fixes it. And here you see Google map images of the same procedure. And then this can, of course, the shape of this final parabolic dune depends on the velocity of the growth of vegetation. You have different velocities, you get different shapes, and here you get the corresponding Google Earth images. And finally, as I said, we stop with Mars. Mars also has dunes, but they look different than from Earth. They are more, the Barakans are more clumsy. I call them cockroach dunes. And what we now did is we took all the parameters of the model here and said, let's now replace the parameters by the Mars parameters. But there's all this gamma, which I showed you before, this gamma here, remember? And this gamma we don't know on Mars. So I said to my student, why don't you use exactly the same gamma as on Earth? And this was stupid from my side. So he did. He took all the parameters of Earth and replaced them by Mars parameters, and then he also took the gamma equal gamma of 0.4, which is the gamma on Earth. And what he found was nothing. And then we just shift-changed gamma until we found dunes. And we found that gamma is 40 times the gamma of the Earth. And these dunes that we get look like the cockroaches. And here you see, this is now a Mars dune. This is calculation. And this is the Earth dune. And this is a calculation. So you see, they are really looking very different. So in that sense, I can say that just looking at the shapes, using the equations, we were able to get the microscopic parameter of mass of sand transport on Mars. Okay, there are these many, this is on Titan, longitudinal dunes, so just to tell you that there are many more things that can be done. And so let me first give you the outlook that I give to the physics or to the geophysics community. So first of all, we can study many types of dunes. We can change the direction of the wind. We can study techniques to destroy dunes, which are used. We can study dunes underwater or snow dunes. We can also improve our vegetation model. But then for mathematical people, there are also some interesting questions. As I mentioned, the stability analysis of transverse dunes is an open question. And then I would like to mention that the solitons of the Kadomtsev-Yashvili equation very much look like the Barakan ones. And that in fact, this was the reason why I actually started to work on this. Because I saw these solutions and thought maybe one can match, one can get them. So the history showed that it is not so easy. And the equations that we got are very different from the Kadomtsev-Yashvili. But maybe it is possible, like one does in fluid dynamics, to derive the quadratic Defries equations, to derive from our set of equations by intelligent mathematical transformations and also, of course, a little physical insight, then the real, some kind of equation, integral equation. Finally, there is also the question, how much does the Barakan shape or the dune shape depend on the details of the saltation mechanism? How much, if I take another nonlinear equation for the saltation length, for instance, how much would that really modify, how much would that matter? And finally, as you have seen, the separation point when we have this bubble forming is, of course, a singular point and very susceptible to numerical noise. And on that point, certainly, also one can make some more investigation. Thank you very much.